Thank you, Sally. Appreciate the introduction. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. My name is Tad Tobey. I'm privileged to serve as president of the Cred Foundation and chairman of Tobey Philanthropies, and I will serve as your chair of the evening for tonight's program. Today's program is part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values series, underwritten by the Corrette and Tobey Charitable Foundations. Now it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's distinguished speaker, Dennis Prager, syndicated talk radio host and author of the new book, Still the Best Hope, Why the World Needs American Values to Triumph. Dennis Prager is one of the most listened to and respected media personalities in America. He has a nationally syndicated radio show, is a best-selling author, writes a syndicated column, and has written for the Los Angeles Times, the Wall Street Journal, and Commentary Magazine. Mr. Prager has been broadcasting on radio in Los Angeles since 1982. His popular show became nationally syndicated in 1999. Dennis Prager has traveled to 100 countries, lectured in Russian in Russia, and in Hebrew in Israel. He has taught Russian and Jewish history at his alma mater, Brooklyn College, conducted orchestras, created an internet-based Prager University. He has lectured in 45 states and on all seven continents. The Los Angeles Times has called him, quote, a moralist whose mission in life is to get people obsessed with what is right and wrong. You'll have to explain that, Dennis. Mr. Prager has engaged in significant amounts of interfaith dialogue with Catholics at the Vatican, Muslims in the Persian Gulf, Protestants at Christian seminaries throughout America, and since 1982, Dennis Prager has been teaching the Bible at the University of Judaism. Mr. Prager was a fellow at Columbia University's School of International Affairs, where he did graduate work at the Middle East and Russian Institutes, and he was appointed by President Reagan to the U.S. delegation to the Vienna Review Conference on the Helsinki Accords. He has written five books, including the seminal work on anti-Semitism titled Why the Jews, and the bestseller Happiness is a Serious Problem. Mr. Prager's latest book, Still the Best Hope, Why the World Needs American Values to Triumph. In this book, he contends that humanity confronts a monumental choice. The world must decide between American values and its two oppositional alternatives, Islamism and European-style socialism. This will be the focus of Mr. Prager's remarks today. Please join me in a warm Commonwealth Club welcome for Dennis Prager.
Do I do the gavel as well? No, I'm serious. I want to do whatever the protocol is. I don't? All right, fine. All right, fair enough. Tad, thank you for those kind comments, and Sally, thank you. It's a pleasure to meet. I had had Sally Pipes on my show often when we finally meet here in San Francisco, even though we both live in Southern California. It's a bit odd, but that's the way it works. Well, I'm told this is the hardest part for me. The hardest part is to keep my remarks to a half hour. That's what I've been asked to do, then I will have to do it. I'm trained sort of like a SEAL to do this because I have to finish a thought for the next commercial on radio. It's a fixed time I have. Nevertheless, I often say when I speak, I studied speaking under Fidel Castro, so I like a couple of hours, frankly, to get started. But be that as it may, I will adhere to the protocol and stick to a half hour and hope that I engendered some discussion in you. It's very hard for me to do. There are really three books in my book, American Values, Islamism, which I will explain in a moment, and Leftism. And I need to explain something, which I do in the book so repeatedly that I actually was afraid that some reviewers might say Prager repeats himself, which I do. And that is, I repeat a point which I need you to know at the outset. I critique ideas, not people. Unless the person has done great evil, an Osama bin Laden, a Stalin, a Hitler, I am known on my radio show for 30 years, never to attack individuals, but to attack ideas. And it's both selfish and noble. The selfish is I want them to come on my show. Why would you ever want to go on somebody's show to be insulted? The noble is I don't believe that it's right to do that because I always begin with the assumption that most people I differ with mean well. They're wrong, in my opinion, often terribly wrong, even dangerously wrong, but not bad. And I always bring my personal life into these matters. Just now, my wife needed stitches. My wife came up with me from Los Angeles and for the talk here. She cut herself rather badly in L.A. this morning and still decided to come. That's why I'm happily married, in a nutshell. But she needed stitches. It was clear. So we went to a local hospital, and the doctor asked me why we're up here, and I said, I'm speaking at the Commonwealth Club, and he said, on what? I told him the name of my book, which pretty much gives my political stance away, since the subtitle, after all, is Why the World Needs American Values to Triumph. And I got a look that I would expect from someone in San Francisco. I mean, it was not shocking, and I reminded him of his Hippocratic Oath. But I don't think he needed to be reminded. He was anyway, the point I want to make is a very serious one. He was a wonderful man. And there's no question we are opposite politically. And I write this in the book constantly. I think leftism is a real danger. And the killer for me who believes that is that I like so many people who are on the left. They're in my family. Not my immediate, I'm happy to say, but on my near immediate. I mean, I have nephews and nieces and cousins who all, I would say that the majority of Pragers in the family voted for Barack Obama. And I love them. And I love them because they're wonderful people. I don't love them because of blood ties. Blood doesn't mean anything to me, which is why I love American values, and I'll explain that momentarily. But I learned, and I tell my listeners this all the time. In fact, if you read, I have a syndicated column. If you read some of the critiques of my column, my last column, on some of the conservative websites, you will see Prager is naive about liberals. He really does think a lot of them are nice. And a lot of them aren't. And by the way, some folks on my side aren't nice. So I just need you to know that in advance in case, I assume this is a mixed political audience. I don't start with you're bad. I start with you're wrong. And by the way, that was a trip, not trip in the 60s sense. It was a journey, not a trip. It was a journey to come to that. After all, hey, folks, I've got the classic liberal bona fides, New York, Columbia, Jewish. I mean, it's almost redundant to say that a New York, Jewish, Columbia University graduate is liberal. It's just liberal is just, as I say, almost redundant. And to be honest, although this is not essential to my book because it's not about me. What drove me rightward, and then later many other things, but the original was my greatest passion is a hatred of evil. And by evil, and as I say in the introduction, it's a tragedy that it has to be defined. We live in an age of such relativism that you have to define the word evil, but so be it. Evil is Hitler, is Stalin, is Kim Il-sung, is Mao, is mass murder, mass torture, mass enslavement, okay? That's evil. And I found it at an early age that this didn't bother my fellow Americans on the left or Europeans on the left or Asians on the left as much as it bothered us folks on the right. So when Ronald Reagan called the Soviet Union an evil empire, the left erupted. And I don't only mean the far left, I mean the New York Times left. He was berated, he was ridiculed for calling the Soviet Union an evil empire. That's when I snapped. I snapped really when I when I was in graduate school and the kids were marching, chanting Ho 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 Chi Minh. Now, it's one thing to think that the U.S. shouldn't have been in Vietnam. Good people can differ on that. Good people cannot differ on Ho 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 Chi Minh. Ho Chi Minh was a Stalinist. He was a butcher in his own right. He was despicable. But he wasn't despicable at Columbia. There were kids walking around with Mao's Red Book. Mao, who has murdered 75 million Chinese. What gives here? So what bothers you, my dear fellow citizens of the world on the left? And then I realized it wasn't evil. It was material inequality. And that's true to this day. We are not animated by the same impulses. There are fine and kind people on both sides and awful people on both sides. But our impulses are different. The animating impulse, what really ticks the right off is evil. And what really ticks the left off is inequality. That's a big difference. It's a big, big difference. And frankly, I don't give a damn about material inequality. Okay? I don't. I care about how those on the lowest end of the material inequality spectrum are living. That matters to me. What is their objective reality? Do they have food? Do they have shelter? Do they have medical care? That matters to me. But whether there is a gulf or not matters to people. The more it matters to you, the more I know how far left you are, or how much left, not even far left. Material inequality doesn't disturb me. Just as, apparently, Mao's atrocities didn't disturb the left. We're disturbed by different things. There are unbridgeable gaps between left and right. And so the book describes two alternatives to the American value system. Since I am preoccupied with evil, I have a question. What is there a system most likely to produce a good society? There are three alternatives, viable alternatives in the world today. Leftism, Islamism, and Americanism. Two of them everybody knows about. One, even most American conservatives don't know about. Americanism, and it's not, I did not coin the term. David Gelernter, a professor at Yale, has written all about Americanism. Others have written about it. There are three religions. These are three religions. Leftism is a religion, albeit usually secular. Americanism, and of course Islamism. Islamism, by the way, my definition for Islamism is those who wish to have Sharia-based societies. The individual Muslim who fasts during Ramadan, who makes the Hajj to Mecca, is not my issue. I am not even anti-fundamentalist Muslims. I am anti-having a Sharia-based state. As a Jew, who is a religious Jew, though not Orthodox, I am opposed to a halacha based state. Halacha is the Jewish equivalent, if you will. It's Jewish law. Now, of course, Jews only restricted it to Israel, so it was never an issue. There would never be a halacha-based state outside of Israel, but I'm opposed to it even in Israel. I don't mind that the Israeli army only serves kosher food. It's to make it possible for all recruits to eat. But beyond that, if you want to have pork on Yom Kippur and you live in Israel, that should be your right to do so. I would not eat on Yom Kippur, let alone pork. But if you as a Jew want to do so, I will fight for your right to do so. But that is not permeated the Islamic world, that notion. I'll fast on Ramadan, but what if you want to have some liquor, man, that's fine with me. But that idea has not permeated. That's why I want American values to triumph. What are American values? American values have not been defined generally. They are intimated, they are intuited, they are implied, they are inferred. What are they? I didn't know. My parents didn't know. My father was a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy during World War II fighting in the Pacific. But if you'd say to him, he's thank God still alive and well. Dad, what are American values? In fact, I'm going to ask him. I'm going to call, he just had a pacemaker put in yesterday at 93, and I'm going to call him up. As soon as he told me how attractive the nurse was, I knew he's doing well. And so so I'm going to ask him, Dad, what are American values? It would be very interesting to see what he would say. I wasn't taught them. I don't think he was taught them. I don't think American values have been taught for nearly the better part of a century. Society that doesn't teach its own values isn't going to survive. We don't teach our own values. So I didn't know them. But there they were, one night, getting ready to go to bed, emptying my pockets. I looked at the coins on my sink. Ta-da! The good old epiphany, close to a theophany. There they were, on every coin, on every paper note. Liberty and God we trust, e pluribus unum. Why didn't anybody tell me that? Well, in a sense, they've been telling me that ever since my grandmother gave me little shiny pennies as a kid. But who reads the stuff? It's so obvious. I'll tell you how obvious it is that, and how hidden it is. I bet that unless you've studied it or been to Congress, you don't know the answer to this. What are the words emblazoned above where the Vice President of the United States and the Speaker of the House sit when the President gives a talk to a joint session of Congress? Okay, well, all right, fine. Don't say. I just want to know how many think you know. Emblazoned, two, three, and this is four. You're four more than almost ever. This is a particularly well-informed. I didn't know. But I was invited by my congressman to sit in the Speaker's gallery when the President gave his speech to the joint session of Congress a couple of years ago on behalf of what became known as Obamacare. And I was stunned. Giant letters chiseled in the gorgeous marble of the Hall of Congress. Giant letters, in God we trust. You know why you didn't know? Because they never pan out when the President speaks. I am certain that it's deliberate. Certain. Not conspiratorial. I believe in no conspiracies. Nobody ever told a cameraman, never pan out. They're too embarrassed to pan out. It's an embarrassment to the elite. If it were shown behind any president, Republican or Democrat, in God we trust. Give me a break, man. And my congressman told me, Dennis, you've never been on the floor of Congress, but you know what's facing the president when he speaks? Moses and the Ten Commandments. Talk about an embarrassment. Oh, my God, my professors at Columbia. I wrote a piece for one of my professors who was a good atheist and leftist at the Russian Institute of Columbia. And I wrote it on a comparison of Judaism and Marxism. And the guy was stunned. He didn't know why they let me in. Somebody actually believes in religion and is studying in my class. It was like I was an embarrassment. But in any event, to his credit, he gave me a B. And it became part of my first book I ever wrote, The Nine Questions People Ask About Judaism, on the chapter of the differences between Judaism and Marxism. So these are the three values: liberty, in God we trust, e pluribus unum. No country in the world has them as their three values. None. Differ with them, you may want to reject them, you may want to overthrow them, but you can't deny that they are central. Liberty is individual liberty. And individual liberty is based on small government. The bigger the government, the less the liberty. It's like it is a pie. You can't have both. Giant government and giant liberty don't work. The bigger the, what does big government mean? It means it controls more of the space of society. That's all. We want you to be in trains, not cars. That's a liberty issue. We want to take more of your money, as much of your money as possible. That's a liberty issue. Beyond anything else, it's a liberty issue. But liberty is not animating to Islam historically or to leftism. It's not animating. Good people can differ, but it's not an animating value. It's an animating American value. The smaller the government, the more the liberty. Now, obviously, you get a certain point where you have such a small government that you can't even have law and order, then you lose your liberty, because anarchy is not liberty, because people are free to kill you, obviously. So everybody acknowledges a certain size of government is necessary, but as small as possible and not greater than that. That was the American dream. And it may turn out to be a dream. Because the human being is not, I do not believe I differed with the president, President Bush, on this. He said that human beings yearn for freedom. It's not true. Human beings yearn for security, not liberty. And between the two, therefore, leftism much more comports to human nature than does American values. I want to be taken care of is far more deep than I want liberty. Liberty schmiberty, I want you to take care of me. I want you to take care of my parents. I want you to take care of my children. I want you to take care of my community. The American value was I take care of me. I take care of my parents. I take care of my children. I take care of my community. That's not normal. The human being and the elite of humanity want the state to take care of you, your children, your parents, your community. They want them to educate your children. They want to put your children in daycare centers. They don't even want you to raise your children. That's the ultimate European / left-wing American ideal. We will raise your children. We will educate your children. And you will have as few of them as possible in any event, because the environment is ultimately affected, and that is a supreme value on the left. These are powerful differences. I am not sanguine as to American values winning. I am not. I'm sorry to say it, because I don't say it on the radio. I don't want to depress my audience. I'm serious. It's an actual tension that I have between telling my audience every day for 3 hours what I think, and on the other hand, I don't want to depress them. By the way, obviously, I wouldn't have spent the years that it took me to write this book if I didn't think there was hope. I think there's tremendous hope for this to prevail. I think that the American DNA is still intact vis-a-vis liberty, but it's tenuous because they are raised by teachers who believe in equality, material equality, who believe in security, who believe in the state, not in the parents. That's liberty. Then in God we trust. The founders understood brilliantly that people are not basically good. By the way, that was another one of my immediate realizations, that what I was taught, I went to yeshiva till I was 18, which is religious Jewish schooling. And then, and I've written 2 books on Judaism, and I continue to write on Judaism, and I've done a commentary, I'm doing a commentary on the Torah, so this is a very big part of my life. And I realized there was a tremendous tension between secular education and religious education, including Christian religious education. Every Christian in a traditional Christian school, every Jew in a traditional Jewish school is taught that people are not basically good. The antithesis of what I was taught at Columbia. People are basically good. That's why people believe that poverty causes crime. If you're a traditional Christian or Jew, you think that's nonsense. Bad values cause crime, not poverty. If poverty caused crime, India would have been hell. Well, I've been to India 4 times. It was eye-opening to me when I first went to India in my 20s. Eye-opening. And it's driven the LA Times editorial board crazy and the New York Times editorial board nuts that there's no rise in violent crime during this recession. So they keep saying, well, sociologists, experts are just stymied by this. I'm not stymied. They're not connected. Values is everything, not economic situation. People are not basically good. That's basic Jewish teaching, basic Christian teaching, basic all teachings in the world until the Enlightenment, which celebrated humanity. After all, if you don't believe in God, you better believe in man, or you get very depressed. So when they stopped believing in God, they started believing in humanity. And as I have written, I have contempt for humanity, but I love individuals. I love people, but I have contempt for humanity. Unlike many of my fellow students at Columbia who loved humanity and treated people despicably. It's easy to love humanity. That's why the great phrase is love your neighbor as yourself, not love everyone as yourself. It's easy to love everyone. It's hard to love your neighbor. So, that was the second great value. In God we trust. If people are not going to be basically good, which we're not, well, there are two possibilities then of having a good world, the founders realized and common sense suggests. Two possibilities only. Either they are accountable morally to the state or accountable morally to God. The notion of accountable morally to oneself is such drivel that it's painful for me to even state the sentence. You have to have gone to graduate school to believe something that foolish. Oh, I don't need a God or a state. I am so great that all I have to do is be accountable to my conscience. Okay? Excuse me, but I don't buy it. Okay? Nazi consciences were clean. Communist consciences were clean. But that's why the self-esteem movement started on the left here in California. Nobody has the self-esteem of the left. We are better, finer, kinder than the right. The right doesn't believe they're finer, better, and kinder. They think they're smarter in the sense of having better answers, but not smarter initially or any other way. We're six herbs: sexist, intolerant, xenophobic, homophobic, Islamophobic, racist, bigoted. We don't have those labels for the left. The left is just W, wrong. That's it, just wrong, not anything else. But we are all these terrible things. Anyway, you better be accountable to God, and that's why when I grew up, it's dead. The term is dead. Ask a kid at Harvard or at Montana State Community College, what does God-fearing mean? And you will get a blank stare. It's as archaic as horseshoes. But for much of American history, that was synonymous with a good person. Now it's state-fearing. That's what it is. It's either you either fear the state or you fear God. I trust the society like we made in America that was more God-fearing. And third, e pluribus unum, from many one. Unique, this is the most un-xenophobic country in the history of the world and to this day. The left says xenophobia is American as apple pie, but it is not true. We are the least xenophobic. You become an American, we don't care what accent, what race, what nationality, what ethnicity, you are American. I saw it in the Rotary Club, the quintessential American group. I joined a Rotary Club for 3 years in my late 20s in Simi Valley, California. They couldn't care less where you were from, what your accent was. Third generation Turks in Germany are still Turks. Third generation Turkish American here, nobody gives a hoot. He's totally American. She's totally American. This was the first country to say blood doesn't matter. Lawrence Harrison taught at Tufts and at Harvard, USAID in South America his whole life, wrote a book on, Who Succeeds? I think it's called Who Succeeds. And he asked, why did America so succeed and Latin America not? Tremendous land, tremendous opportunity, tremendous natural resources. And he said, I'll tell you one of the biggest reasons, familism. No familism in America. Familism is universal. Discrimination on the basis of family. I only trust my blood. Americans don't trust whoever does a good job. If a non-relative does a better job, we hire him. Who does the best job? I have a great quote in the book from Saakashvili, the president of Georgia, where he saw people of every background, Middle East, Asian, African. Said, I saw them all. They all looked American. They all sounded American. They all had American body language. What does to look American mean? Exactly. We know what Swedes look like. We know what Germans look like. We know what Africans look like. Do we know what Americans look like? There's no such thing. E pluribus unum, what a magnificent achievement. And with it, and with this I conclude because of the time factor, a deep belief in nationalism. Again, contra to the left, which is internationalism. They're citizens of the world. We're citizens of the United States. Remember, the subtitle of my book is Why the World Needs American Values to Succeed, to Triumph. Because American values are applicable everywhere. I just spoke in Sydney, Australia last month, and they asked me, how was your book? Why would I want to read your book here? Because I said, just on this alone. These values are completely applicable to every society. You don't have to change your religion. You don't have to change your nationality. You don't have to become American. Nothing. The more Australians consider themselves, the better it is. I want Ecuadorians to feel Ecuadorian. It's a healthy thing, the national unit. If African countries had more nationalism, they'd be much better off because they're divided by tribes. They don't kill each other based on nations. They kill each other based on tribes, based on blood. Americanism shatters blood. That's why we're big believers in adoption. The biggest believers in the world in adoption of people of other races are Americans, because it doesn't mean a damn. I'm an adoptive father. It means nothing to me. People ask me, which of your sons is adopted? I say, I forgot. It's my standard answer. Doesn't mean a damn thing to me. Blood schmud. That's what I think of blood. And why? I'm an American man. That's why. Because I really believe in this system. And we better teach it, because we're losing it. Because leftism, as well-intentioned as so many people who believe in it, is antithetical to Americanism. Doesn't mean you're not a good American if you're a leftist. There are leftists who die for this country. I want to make that clear again. I'll say it over and over. It's not ad hominem. It's ad subjectum. This is the greatest system ever created for making a good society, and we have largely succeeded in doing so if you compare America to other societies, not to utopia. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Our thanks to Dennis Prager, syndicated radio talk radio host and author of his new book, Still the Best Hope, Why the World Needs American Values to Triumph. I'm Sally Pipes, President and CEO of the Pacific Research Institute, and your moderator for the audience question period. We have a number of questions, so let us begin. I'll ask the first question since I'm the moderator. We have seen in Europe, Spain, Portugal, Greece, France, a lot of these countries which have had tremendous anti-American values sentiment. They're really entitled. They've become entitlement societies. They're not working. And here in America, we seem to be moving that way. Our president really believes in an entitlement society. How do we get young people to change their vision of living in an entitlement society when we will have more people getting things from government than contributing to our society?
This, Sally, is one of the reasons that I said I wasn't sanguine. There is something more powerful than heroin. It's money for free, things for free. It's an addiction that is almost impossible to break. Once you get something without working for it, it becomes impossible, virtually impossible, not to get it any longer or to break free from it. We are corrupting character when we give people things for nothing. See, we always gave charity. I come from a Jewish tradition where charity and justice are the same word in Hebrew. Tzedakah means the Hebrew word used for charity actually means justice. And I have spoken for more UJA evenings, United Jewish Appeal. It's now United Jewish Communities. It was a good name to begin with, but they changed it. In any event, then I can count. Probably not 1,000. Many, many hundreds of evenings. And it is a beautiful thing to see the charity, the charitable contributions that Jews give. It was considered to be a shame, or as they said in Yiddish, a shanda, for a Jew to accept money from the government. Jews should take care of Jews. Bill Maher just mocked the massive charitable contributions of Mitt Romney. Oh, he just gives to the Mormon church. It doesn't mean a damn thing. After all, he said, and this was the key line, he said, hey, did you ever meet a poor Mormon? And the audience went ballistic because they're on the same level as he. And they thought it was a great line. But maybe the reason we don't meet poor Mormons is because Mormons take care of Mormons. So the very notion itself, his own comment was totally undermined his original mockery of Mormons giving to the church. Yes, because the church takes care of Mormons and Jews took care of Jews. God, I would love to see the wealthiest blacks take care of more blacks. Be an awesome moment. Can't say these things, of course, because of the totalitarian nature of political correctness. But true is true. Take care of your own. First you take care of your own is a great idea. Now it's the state will take care of all of us. See, when the Mormon church takes care of you, you know it's not free. That other Mormons gave of their money, tithed themselves to give this. When other Jews did it, you knew it wasn't just out there. But when the government gives a food stamp and you have a credit card for food stamps, you didn't take it from anybody. It's like the kids who tell me they would steal from a department store, but they wouldn't steal from a mom and pop store. That's the mentality. The government, oh, what's the government? Just took from the rich. The rich didn't pay their fair share. The corruption of all of this, the moral corruption is so deep. So you're right, I do worry. And if I would talk to kids, I would say, you're being made worse. You are being given heroin. The drug seller is the state. And what do they want in return? Your vote. It's a great deal. Vote for us, we give you more money. Republicans can't say that. Vote for us, we give you less money. It's amazing Republicans win any election. They promise you less money. It's an amazing thing.
I miss your daily radio broadcast that used to be available in San Francisco. Is it still available? How can we tune in?
Well, the San Francisco station turned over to a business station. It just happens every so often. That's free enterprise, and I don't begrudge it. So I am on in Sacramento, a very popular station there. I'm on all over California, but not San Francisco. It's easy to hear, however. There's even an app for my show, The Dennis Prager Show, available for your phone. You can hear it on the Internet. Just go to DennisPrager.com. It's very easy to hear the show. I have listeners. One of my favorite calls 2 weeks ago from a listener in Norway. It was a great moment for me, actually. I have listeners all over the world. I saved a marriage in Brazil with my male-female hour. That was my high point of my radio career. Where I got a letter from a woman, because I do 1 hour a week on male-female relations. I don't only care about politics. In fact, I personally care about politics less than I care about these other issues. My last book was Happiness, and I talk about happiness more than I talk about politics. But this is too important, so I spent these years writing this book. This Norwegian called up. He's a Norwegian, not an American living in Norway, a Norwegian. Happened to come across my show. And he said it changed my life. He said it on the air, to turn me around. Because I was talking about Breivik and how you can't be a member of the European Union and you can't be a bona fide leftist if you're for capital punishment. The left hates capital punishment. It's one of the basic Judeo-Christian principles that murderers should die. It's in my book. I have an explanation of Judeo-Christian principles in the book. This is an unbridgeable gap. People who think that Israel was immoral for executing Eichmann have a different mode of thought than I do. I admit it. And they could be nice and kind and good parents and good people and sweet, but the gulf between us is unbridgeable. That Norway thinks Breivik should be given 21 years. That's the maximum sentence for death. So Breivik, this monster who killed 77 people, murdered 77 mostly young people in Norway, will serve maximum of 21 years, and that comes to about 4 months per person. And the people who are opposed to capital punishment say that their opposition elevates the worth of human life, whereas I believe it cheapens the worth of human life, keeping Breivik alive. But, as I said, it's an unbridgeable gulf. But anyway, that you can hear the show in a multitude of ways. And I might add as well, I've started another project called Prager University, five-minute courses of the finest minds in the world, speaking for 5 minutes with great, great illustrations. It's worth visiting. And the hope is, again, to change lives.
You're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our guest today is Dennis Prager, syndicated radio talk show host and author who is discussing his view that American values also hold the key to success for the world at large. Our next question is, what is the influence of talk radio today? How do you rate fellow conservatives, Sean Hannity and Rush Limbaugh? And is it fair to say that conservative media is now fairly represented in the American discourse?
The United States, the only country with talk radio as such. It is one of the reasons that conservatism has had a renaissance in the United States and has been influential. And that is one of the reasons that many folks on the left would like to shut us down or shut as many of us down as possible with various FCC rulings on who gets to own stations or a fairness doctrine, which I said is fine. I'm totally for a fairness doctrine. Okay? I will give up half my time to a liberal to broadcast if the New York Times gives up half of its editorial space to conservatives. And NPR does the same, and PBS and NBC and ABC and so on. If they do the same thing, I would happily give up half my... You won't even need us. That's fine. I will then just talk about happiness. I'll be thrilled to do so. We are very influential because there is nothing else articulating the non-left-wing view of life in the United States. There is the Wall Street Journal editorial page. There are some of the programs on Fox News. And that's about it. That's about it. And talk radio. I said, whenever I have European conservatives on, all 36 of them have been on the show. And when I have them on, they acknowledge if they were talk radio in Europe, it would be a different continent. But the BBC runs everything. The French equivalent runs everything. It's just you can't even broadcast without a government license. The government. So it's as if everything is there for PBS and NPR and even to the left of that. So I am part of a very powerful an almost singular antidote to the permeation of the society by values left of center from kindergarten. And here in California, from kindergarten on, textbooks will have to now include, this was a law passed last year, that the contributions of gays, lesbians, transsexuals, transgendered, and bisexuals will have to be part of all textbooks or they cannot be sold or used in California. I was unaware of the lack of attention to transgendered in the American Revolution. I'll be very curious to see what they come up with. Is General so-and-so? Did he fight an address? I don't mean at all. I don't mean to be. I can't make up a scenario as silly as the law, but the law's totalitarian. I don't want special chapters on Jews in American textbooks, and I'm Jewish. I want truth in American textbooks. But for the left, truth and feeling good collide. Gee, what if they're all WASPs? Oh, no. We don't want that to be. Then non-WASPs will feel bad. Since feelings is, as I prove, I think, in my book, feelings is the basis of leftism. It's all emotive. People may feel offended if there's a Christmas tree. People may feel offended if Alaska Airlines gives its prayer little biblical statement cards with its meal, so they drop the... Always worried about people feeling offended. I'm not offended by Merry Christmas. I insist on having people say Merry Christmas. If they say to me Happy Holidays, I answer back Merry Christmas. I wish everybody Merry Christmas during the Christmas season. Happy Holidays is a joke. You know what my answer to Happy Holidays is? And you might want to adopt it. What holidays did you have in mind? It's a good one. Yeah. Kwanzaa? Was that what you're thinking of Kwanzaa when you said Happy Holidays? But that's the totalitarian nature of things. That's exactly what we're fighting against. Yep.
Since you don't support large government, then you must not support the repair and new development of infrastructure, roads, water, the military, etc. Of course, there's the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act as well. Could you comment on this?
There is no conservative who is against government, period. We're against too much government. It's like saying to a hypochondriac that you're opposed to hypochondria. Well, who's going to perform neurosurgery? Neurosurgeons will. We're just not for your going to support your hypochondria. There is a hypochondriatic government involved here, where government is involved just too much, and it is far too large. And I don't know, can anybody, no, I'm not going to even put it as a rhetorical question. No one can demonstrate an improvement in education since the Department of Education was created. Every single standard of education in America has deteriorated since that happened. Now, you can say, but it's not related. Fine. Maybe it didn't cause the deterioration, but it certainly didn't stop it. It's a wasteland. What that has to do with repairing bridges? Maybe if we got rid of the Department of Education, we could, in fact, build more bridges with that money saved.
I appreciated your contrasting the left's distrust of big business, but embracing big government. Is this not a double standard?
Well, I just dealt with this on my show. This notion of somehow contrasting and comparing big business and big government. So let me make something very clear, since again I return to my original comments that I am preoccupied with evil. Okay. No big business. No big business created a genocide. Big governments make genocides. Big business may be corrupt, but Pepsi-Cola didn't make Auschwitz. Coca-Cola didn't kill 75 million Chinese. There's no private enterprise in any totalitarian state of the left. There was private enterprise in Hitler's Nazi Germany. Agreed. But they didn't create that either. This notion of somehow one is as dangerous as the other, the left is preoccupied with big business. I'm preoccupied with big government because big government slaughters people, not big business. I don't fear a knock on my door from Standard Oil. That's my answer. There's no comparison.
Your three pillars, American Trinity, as you mentioned, need to be retrofitted. Do you have a prescription?
Do I have a prescription for how they can be embraced? I don't quite follow the question. But my prescription is to reassert these three values. There's no, again, it's in my book, I think it's the most coherent analysis of the left in its totality that I know of. And there are many great books on it. I don't claim to be the only one. But this love of change is amazing to me. I don't love change. I don't disdain change, and I don't love change. If the change is good, I like it. If the change isn't good, I don't like it. But the left loves change. They love youth. That's why wisdom is at a premium at universities, because they love change. Why study DWEM, dead white European males? It's so pathetic, this notion of quality doesn't matter, but again, back to the issue of having people feel good about themselves in textbooks. The New York Times listed Anthony Tomasini, chief music critic, New York Times. I, as you heard, I conduct orchestras. I'm very involved in classical music. And so I was reading, he had a listing last year of the 10 greatest composers who ever lived. So I'm curious to read, and I fully acknowledge that we might differ. He might put Handel on. He might not put Handel on. I respect that. But he didn't put Haydn in the list. He put in Stravinsky, put in Debussy, and he put in Bartok. I don't know any living human who, if told you, have to go to an island with only one composer's records, will it be Bartok or Haydn? Who would say, no, Bartok any day. You're kidding. Of course. But so be it. But why didn't he include Haydn? Haydn, he admitted, is the father of the symphony, the father of the sonata, and the father of the quartet. There's not much left. You know, like, it's really not. That's pretty basic, too. He's the father of much music. You know why he didn't? He told why. Because if he would have put Mozart and Beethoven and, I don't know if he put in Schubert, but and Haydn, he would have had, and I guess maybe Schubert, he would have had four Viennese living within 75 years of each other. So even the list of the 10 greatest composers is affirmative action. Truth and excellence are not left-wing values. Feeling good, diversity, those are.
How do American values become more widespread on college campuses today?
By inviting people like me to speak there.
Yeah.
And I'm dead serious, and it is a shame on the conservative movement that it doesn't do it. The conservative movement is as good at selling conservatism as people are at selling sand in the Sahara. I have always said, and I say this, it's sad, but largely true. There are two parties, in my opinion, the dangerous and the stupid. I'm a member of the stupid. And why people don't know how to sell their own product is a tragedy. I just don't know what to tell you. Why people like me are not sent in droves to college campuses is a scandal. It's just a scandal. And I'm not looking for more money. I earn a very nice income. I'm here for free. I obviously have a lot of passion about what I'm doing. Okay? Nobody gave me a penny to come to speak to you this evening. But why we are not sent around? I was sent to the University of California, Santa Barbara, to speak on Islamofascism. This is a very powerful story. Where David Horowitz, a friend of mine and well-known to many conservatives and to many leftists for that matter, he had National Islamofascism Awareness Week, sent speakers around. And Islamofascism is no more anti-Islam or Islamophobic. It's a terribly despicable term, especially considering there's no such thing as Christianophobic. It's amazing, just amazing. But in any event, he sent people around. It's no more anti-Muslim a term than Catholic fascism is an anti-Catholic term when you're talking about what took place in Croatia. Or Italian fascism is not an anti-Italian term if you talk about Mussolini. But anyway, so I spoke. Article in the UC Santa Barbara paper. Bigot coming to UC Santa Barbara. It was about me. I had the guy on, a kid. I said he was shocked that I had him on the show. Shocked. Because conservatives are supposed to be closed. Or put it this way, we're supposed to be as closed as the University of California's campuses are to conservative ideas. And so I had him on, and I always treat my listeners respectfully, especially kids. I'm not going to bully them. But I said, I'm curious. You must know me better than I do. I know for a fact that I don't have a bigoted bone in my body. I know for a fact. So why did you say I'm a bigot? He said, because you're speaking of the Islamo-Fascism Awareness Week. That makes you a bigot. I said, why does that make me a bigot? What if I came to speak on Catholic fascism or Italian fascism? Anyway, that was a discussion. He came to my lecture as a result of this. His next column, titled, I Apologize to Dennis Prager. One talk turned this kid around. But they don't get this talk. I came to Stanford thanks to the Hoover Institution about 7 years ago. I spoke at Stanford on on a number of things, and I spoke to whoever came, the student body. Needless to say, professors didn't come, but students did. I spoke on anti-Americanism and anti-Zionism, explaining the two of them in my lecture. And to the credit of the Stanford Daily, I was on the front page with a picture the next day. That's to the credit of, and they asked the students who attended, what'd you think? And basically the answer was, I'll never forget one student. I'm a political science major, 4 years at Stanford. Why did I never hear one of these ideas in 4 years? And the answer was because his parents were ripped off. That's why. Because most universities are left-wing seminaries. They're Catholic seminaries, Protestant seminaries, Jewish seminaries, and leftist seminaries. The first three admit that they're there to produce committed Christians and Jews. These don't admit that they're there to produce committed leftists.
Do you believe President Obama shares any of the values that you discuss? And does Mitt Romney share any more of them?
President Obama is an honest leftist. He believes in, there are four trinities that govern the modern world, okay? There is the Christian Trinity, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Ghost. There is the Jewish Trinity, God, Torah, Israel. There is the American Trinity, liberty and God we trust, e pluribus unum, and the left-wing Trinity, race, gender, class. He divides, like the left does, the world, not on the basis of good and evil, but on the basis of black and white, rich and poor, male and female. That's the prism through which you see life, especially the class prism. He is classic, in a sense, a classic Marxist in that way. This is not an insult. It's just a description. That's how you understand life. Hence, the rich are too rich, and that's why the poor are poor. That's a classic left-wing analysis of the economy. Why are the poor poor? Because the rich are too rich. That's it. That's the answer. You take more from them. Listen, the United Nations. Why did the United Nations rank the U.S. and Cuba tied in health care? 37th and 39th, respectively. So tied, basically. You can't get aspirin in Cuba. What kind of brain comes up with the idea that America and Cuba are tied in health care? It's a left-wing brain. Because they don't assess quality, they assess equality. Since almost everybody in Cuba has awful health care, it's right up there at number 39. And we're right down there at 37 because we don't have equal health care. That a poor American has infinitely better health care than the average Cuban is of no consequence because the left assesses by class. That's the prism. We have different prisms. We see the world differently. This is how President Obama sees the world.
I find the acknowledgments to those that helped you, Mr. Prager, like other authors, as interesting as the book. Could you comment on those that helped you?
Oh, I am proud of the acknowledgments part in my book. It's so long they put it at the end. HarperCollins thought it was too long. I basically have thanked everybody except the elevator operator when I was a kid in Manhattan. To be honest, so many people have been important in my life, and I didn't even include all of them, that I always think it's a nice thing to put them in. But with regard to the actual writing of the book, I would say that in this case, and it's 400 footnotes, they're endnotes, so you don't have to worry about it if you don't like footnotes on the page. I happen to like them on the page, but most people don't. Anyway, they're there. I did the research, but in the writing, my wife and my producer of my radio show, Alan Estrin, were instrumental.
As a history teacher, I'm always questioned about why the U.S. intervenes around the world. Do you feel our values drive our foreign policy today?
Not only that, not only do our values drive American foreign policy, but we are the only country or the most driven by values in foreign policy. That's the issue. But to the left, it's imperialism. To me, it's idealism. To the left, it's imperialism. So that's a different read. Why were we in Korea? Tell me, why were we in Korea? 37,000 Americans killed in Korea. And the more you know about North Korea, the more you know how every one of those 37,000 died for a good cause. North Korea is the largest concentration camp in human history. It's one giant concentration camp outside of Pyongyang. And if those Americans hadn't died for people, they couldn't identify Korea on the map, most of the boys who died there. But the idea of dying for liberty is a uniquely American thing. Uniquely. They laugh at us in Europe for this. Because they're prepared to die for a lower retirement age. That's what they really fight for in France. We fight for the liberty of Koreans.
Unfortunately, we've reached the point in our program where we have time for one last question, and I would like to ask it because I'm a healthcare economist. As you know, the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was signed into law just over 2 years ago. The president had two goals, universal coverage and bending the cost curve down. Personally, I don't believe he's going to achieve either. But I wonder, do you believe his ultimate goal is to get us to a really Medicare for all, single-payer system where the government makes all decisions about how we receive our health care?
Yes, and I think that people who are for it have only the good of their fellow citizens in mind. But that is exactly what they would like. They feel that Canada and Britain and France, although France has a more complex system, that is the ideal, that the state will decide and will decide ultimately who will live and who will die, because I don't know if they will pay for my father's pacemaker in the future. 93-year-old man gets a pacemaker. I think that they will look at the numbers and say, you know what, 93, sir, with all respect, we need those funds for a 43-year-old.
Exactly, and that's what's going to happen under IPAB and various things. Our thanks to Dennis Prager, syndicated talk radio host and author of the new book, Still the Best Hope, Why the World Needs American Values to Triumph. Today's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club's American Values series, underwritten by the Corrette and the Tobey Family Foundations. I'm Sally Pipes, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, where you're in the know, is adjourned.
Thank you.